This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 126, A Brave New World. For almost 230 years, the Achaemenid dynasty of Persia ruled a mighty and nigh unchallenged empire, stretching from the Indus River Valley to the shores of Greece, from the Egyptian Nile to the Tian Shan Mountains. In just 5 years, Alexander III, King of Macedon and Lord of all Asia, conquered it all, cementing his legacy as Alexander the Great, before dying in Babylon in 323 BCE. The fate of his empire was immediately contested by his surviving generals, but civil war was nearly averted in an event now known as the Partition of Babylon. Alexander's elder, though psychologically troubled half-brother Aridaeus, was proclaimed King Philip III, better known to histories as Philip Aridaeus. Alexander's Sogdian wife, Roxane, was pregnant at the time, and if she had a son, the plan was for this boy to be made co-king. They could sort out the finer points of future succession crises at a later date. With the king back on the throne, the generals promptly carved up the western half of the empire among themselves, becoming Philip's new and immensely powerful satraps, provincial governors in the old Persian style. For the time being, most of the eastern satraps appointed by Alexander were left in place. Philip Aridaeus was mostly meant to be a figurehead, waiting for his potential nephew to reach adulthood. In the meantime, the council at Babylon appointed an influential general, Perdiccas, to govern the empire as regent. Thus, Philip, Perdiccas, and Roxane started their journey west, to return the seat of government to Macedon's traditional capital of Pella. They left after Alexander's funeral, but even as the trio and their entourage departed Babylon, another royal funeral was already underway. Quite suddenly, and without any official explanation, Parasatis II and Statira the Younger, Alexander the Great's two Persian wives, both Achaemenid princesses, became violently ill and died. There was very little doubt in anybody's mind what had happened. Both women were poisoned. Diodorus Siculus and Plutarch both place the blame on Roxane first and foremost, but that is doubtful. Roxane was the daughter of Oxiartes, a powerful Sogdian noble and now satrap of Peripamisidae, straddling the modern Pakistan-Afghanistan border. However, Roxane was largely a newcomer to the intricate court politics of Macedon and Persia, and had very little reason on her own to fear her fellow widows. It's much more likely that Perdiccas and his fellow generals orchestrated the assassination to ensure a clean and direct line of succession. Neither Perisodis nor Statera were pregnant to anybody's knowledge, but if they became pregnant quickly after Alexander's death, it could have reopened the succession debate. So these two women were removed. An empire of this size was never really at peace in antiquity. And frankly, even today, peace on that scale is an anomaly. Parts of the old Achaemenid domain, like Cappadocia, remained unconquered. There were always small local revolts of some sort, but Perdiccas had to deal with his first major challenge before he even left Babylon. Over the course of Alexander the Great's campaigns, there were several instances where his soldiers refused to continue marching east. On each of these occasions, Alexander left many of them behind to act as the first wave of Greek colonists, settling in the Upper Satrapies, the new Greek name for the provinces east of Babylon. The largest group of these settler veterans were in Bactria. Well, when word of Alexander's demise reached these settlers in the Upper Satrapies, they went into revolt. They had stayed out of fear and respect for the late king, but many of them didn't actually want to be colonists. At Babylon, the age-old satrapy of Media was split in two, the northern part largely corresponding to modern Azerbaijan and the Azeri and Kurdish provinces of Iran, became Lesser Media, ruled by the old Persian satrap Atropates. The rest of the province, including the ancient capital of Ecbatana, became Greater Media, under the Macedonian general Pathon. As the most important and successful leader in the east, Pathon was assigned to deal with these rebels before Perdiccas left. Philon, a Greek from the Thessalian city of Aenianos, was appointed as the rebel general, in command of about 23,000 Greco-Macedonian rebel settlers, and probably some local allies in the Upper Satrapies. Mostly experienced veterans, but also older men who had been phased out of the army after many years of service. Pathon only had access to a Macedonian corps for his army, which had previously been stationed in Babylon, and Perdiccas ordered the eastern satraps to provide soldiers from their own territories. So, Pathon marched with just shy of 22,000 soldiers, almost entirely drawn from the Iranian provinces. It would have looked a lot like an old Achaemenid army massed around a large Hellenistic phalanx. One of the Greeks on Pathon's side was friends with one of the rebel commanders named Letodorus, and Pathon used this connection to sway Letodorus back to the loyalist side of the war. In a tactic almost as old as warfare itself, Letodorus and the 3,000 men under his command formed up for battle when Pathon reached Bactria, but as soon as the loyalist army started to advance, Letodorus ordered his men to retreat, a huge chunk of Philon's phalanx abandoning them threw the rebels into disarray. They couldn't tell if there was some sort of unseen attack already happening, if they were supposed to retreat too, or if this was intentional. But Letodorus's betrayal did open a massive gap in their line. When Pathon's forces reached the confused rebels, they broke into a full-blown retreat, and most of them were quickly encircled and forced to swear fealty to the new regime. Justin's Epitome of Pompeius Trogus and Diodorus are split on why exactly this didn't work. Diodorus says there was a secret order from Perdiccas to prevent Pathon from earning the rebels' loyalty. Justin says the men were angry that they didn't get to loot any rebel villages. Regardless of their reasoning, Pathon's men defied their general and carried out a massacre of captured rebels before looting the rebel camp. Unable to punish 20,000 loyal soldiers, Pathon was forced to return home, disappointed if victorious. Meanwhile, Perdiccas and the new royal family were headed back to Europe, just in time for a revolt on that side of the empire as well. But first, the new regent still had to iron out some of the fine details from the partition at Babylon. Shortly before his death, Alexander had ordered Craterus, one of his most trusted officers, to take command of Macedon as Alexander's regent in Europe. Antipater, who had been governing on the home front since Alexander set out a decade earlier, was supposed to come east and join Alexander on his next campaign. Alexander's death obviously disrupted that plan. Craterus wisely chose to stay in Anatolia with the 10,000 soldiers who were supposed to be going home for retirement. Had he crossed while the succession was still up for debate, it probably would have looked like a power grab to Antipater. To ease the transition into Perdiccan rule, Craterus was given the consolation title of Protector of the Royal Family, and he was told to stay in Cilicia for the time being. Perdiccas, as regent of the whole empire, was supposed to move into Pella and take over day-to-day affairs in Macedon itself, while Antipater remained in charge of Greece. He wasn't going to officially be satrap because technically Greece wasn't conquered, just in league with Macedon. However, superficial a difference that might actually have been. Even before Perdiccas arrived in Anatolia to make this all official, Antipater was already mobilizing his forces for war. Not for control of the empire, but war against Greek rebels. During the first few years of Alexander's conquests, Antipater had fought a protracted war against King Agis III of Sparta, as the Spartans tried to rally Greece against the Macedonian occupation. Most of the Greeks sat that war out, and the Spartans were crushed by Antipater at Megalopolis in 331 BCE. Now the other Greeks kinda wished they had joined in. A little more than a year before he died, Alexander issued a general amnesty for Greeks who had been exiled from their home cities. This proclamation was announced at the Olympic Games of 324 BC, when representatives of all the major Greek cities were gathered in one place. This immediately sparked uproar against various Greek political leaders. Exile was typically a punishment for defeated rivals and political dissidents. Several powerful blocs, like the Athenians and the Aetolian League, had forced defeated foes out of whole cities and given those towns over to their own people. They had no intention of abandoning those gains. As Alexander's conquests came to an end, thousands of Greek mercenaries had flooded back into their homeland, and Leosthenes of Athens was given a secret assignment by his government as soon as they caught word that Alexander was dead. Go hire 8,000 of the late king's veterans and employ them as a private army without any official input from Athens. That spooked Antipater. But since Leosthenes was just hanging around with his private army, not doing anything, nothing happened immediately. As news of Alexander's passing spread, Athens began to act more openly, providing their agent with more funds to arm and armor his troops. As it became clear that Athens was preparing for war, the Aetolian League and the cities of Phocis and Locris pledged their own troops to the cause. The Athenian assembly positioned their city as the leader of Greece once again. And by September of 323, most of northern Greece had sent delegates to Athens. Within a month, several Peloponnesian cities joined as well, though Sparta and most of its allies in their own revolt a decade earlier were still recovering from massive losses and decided to remain militarily neutral. Even on the far side of the Aegean, the island of Rhodes ousted its Macedonian garrison and declared in favor of Athens. This new anti-Macedonian alliance even stretched beyond Greece to include some Molossian cities in Epirus, home and the current residence of Alexander the Great's mother, Olympias, as well as several Illyrian tribes. Less directly, several Thracian tribes had started rebelling against Macedonian draft orders by 325 BC. And by the time Athens was ramping up its own revolt, they received some support from the Odrysian king Seuthes III. Despite these foreign inclusions, the alliance was very deliberately calling itself the Hellenic League, and declaring their conflict the Hellenic War, harkening back to the original Hellenic League that fought against Xerxes' invasion almost 160 years earlier. Now, Macedon was being treated as the Persian invader. However, as a spoiler for how this all went, pro-Macedonian sources later called this the Lamian War, and that is the name used by most historians today. There was just one problem with all of this. The allies in the northern Balkans were cut off by Macedon itself. The allies in northern Greece and Athens were separated by a large Macedonian garrison at the Cadmea, the lone fortress rebuilt on the ruins of Thebes after Alexander destroyed the city, where the Boeotian League feared that the rebels would try to rebuild Thebes and strip other cities in the region of their power. The small number of Peloponnesian allies were cut off from Athens by a Macedonian garrison at Corinth, officially home to the Corinthian League that Macedon used to govern Greece. Euboea, the large island just off of Athens' own coast, remained loyal to Macedon. Still, they fought. Leosthenes and his mercenaries joined the main Athenian and Aetolian armies for a sudden strike into Boeotia, and again, fully aware of the parallels, brought back some blasts from the past. The Hellenic League fought against the foreign invader and its Greek allies on the plains of Plataea, but this time, the League had a significant numerical superiority. The Hellenic League mustered around 22,000 troops to fight against whatever local militia the loyalist Boeotians could muster on short notice. However, this was not intended to be a campaign of conquest. The Battle of Plataea was mostly just Athens proving a point. So for added symbolism, Leosthenes ordered his forces to withdraw to a more defensible position and await the Macedonian response. Fortunately, there was a somewhat famously defensible position nearby. Leosthenes went to the Hot Gates, Thermopylae, and a further 8,000 men from the Hellenic League cities of Greece met him there. Antipater was forced to respond, despite being quite unprepared for the battle ahead. He had started his term as regent with 13,500 Macedonians at arms, but Alexander kept chipping away at that number for his reinforcements. So by late 323 BCE, Antipater was still able to muster 13,000 infantry and 2,600 cavalry, but only after pulling every available soldier from the Greek cities that remained loyal into one army. This does make the comparison to Xerxes a little half-hearted. Xerxes' forces had dwarfed the Greek defenders at Thermopylae in 480 BC. Now, in 323, Antipater was assaulting the pass with half as many men as its defenders. Leosthenes, on the other hand, had more than enough men to guard both Thermopylae itself and the infamous Shepherd's Path that circumvented the main road. It also didn't do much to help Antipater when 2,000 of his Thessalian cavalry immediately rode off and joined the rebel army. To complete the mirrored image of the Persian invasion, a force of 200 Athenian ships fought against 110 Macedonians off the coast as a sort of latter-day Battle of Artemisium, though it wasn't in the exact same location. Ironically, Athens and its allies actually had a much, much larger navy at their disposal, totaling over 400 vessels, including many of the recently developed quadraremes, and even 7 massive quinqueremes that dwarfed the traditional trireme. These were ships that had once made up the bulk of the Macedonian navy, but were actually from Alexander's Greek subject cities. However, the Neo-Hellenic League could only field enough sailors to crew 200 ships. Needless to say, Antipater could not overcome the Greek defenses and was forced to withdraw north to the city of Lamia, which he fortified with siege weapons to use as artillery. Leosthenes gave the order to pursue, and the Greeks besieged Lamia. There was just one problem. The city was stockpiled with food and missile weapons. The Greek army didn't have any siege weapons to break through the walls, and the defenses were too strong to climb. So Leosthenes tried starving them out. His forces dug a wide moat and built a smaller second wall around Lamia to cut off supplies and lines of escape. But now it was just a waiting game. This could have worked, but near the end of 323 BC, the Macedonians sent out an attack force to disrupt the construction of the moat. In the skirmish, Leosthenes himself was killed. His successor as general, Antiphilos of Athens, demanded an unconditional Macedonian surrender, which Antipater obviously refused, so they carried on with the siege. But the Greeks remained optimistic. A Congress of Greek states gathered in Athens, joined by the anti-Macedonian firebrand Demosthenes, ironically freshly returned from an exile originally imposed on him by the pro-Macedonian government. Meanwhile, the Athenian and Rhodian navies were hard at work prosecuting a naval war against Macedon. Shortly before marching south, Antipater reached out to his allies in Anatolia, offering a marriage pact via one of his daughters to Leonatus, the newfound satrap of Hellespontine Phrygia, and he gave Craterus the green light to return to Europe if he brought those 10,000 troops with him for one last fight before their retirement. Now, Rhodes had its ships patrolling the coast of Cilicia, pinning Craterus down on the Asian side of the sea, and the Athenian navy was desperately battling Leonidas for control of the Hellespont, as always a vital lifeline between Athens and grain from the Greek Bosporan kingdom in modern Crimea. Leonidas theoretically had the manpower to repel the Athenians. Unfortunately, that meant that the Hellenic navy was unavailable to besiege Lamia, and their Macedonian counterparts continued to resupply Antipater by sea, prolonging the siege even as additional warships were under construction in Macedonian harbors. Up in the north, Lysimachus, now satrap of Thrace, was busy fighting against King Seuthes and his Odrysian kingdom. Concurrent with the siege of Lamia, Lysimachus and Seuthes' armies fought a battle with massive Thracian casualties, until the Macedonians were forced to abandon the battlefield anyway, which drew that theater of the war into a stalemate for the time being. Ultimately, it was Leonidas who managed to intervene. he set aside a full army, 20,000 infantry and 1,500 cavalry, to assist in the final Macedonian push into Cappadocia, which was still resisting conquest under its pre-Alexandrian Persian satrap. Leonidas diverted these forces to Europe immediately after receiving Antipater's request. He might not be able to beat Athens on the Hellespont, but he still controlled the Dardanelles, and they just crossed at Byzantium instead. It's a slightly longer march, but not that big a deal. Right around this time, the Macedonian Empire was given cause for celebration. And that is where we will pick up after a quick break. In the winter of 323 into 322 BCE, the Dowager Queen Roxane gave birth to a healthy son. The moment he came into the world, this boy was proclaimed Alexander IV, king of his father's empire. Of course, at literal moments old, the new king wasn't going to be governing or leading armies, but it did mean that everything was going according to plan. A few months after the baby Alexander's birth, in spring of 322, Leonidas and his army entered the plains of Thessaly. Down in Lamia, about 10,000 Greeks had gone home for the winter, mostly the Aetolians. But Antiphilus still commanded 20,000 infantry, and more than twice as much cavalry as Leonidas. So most of the besieging army managed to slip away under cover of darkness and marched north to intercept Leonidas before he could aid Antipater. You didn't actually need 20,000 people to besiege the city for a few days. The battle with Leonidas was a crushing Greek victory. This time, the Greeks had overwhelming cavalry superiority, and they overwhelmed their Macedonian opponents, killing satrap Leonidas in the process. But any celebration was short-lived. Despite the small party left behind, Antipater and his army took this as an opportunity to escape Lamia and fled through the mountains back to Macedon. The Macedonian frontier was too heavily defended for Antiphilus to invade, and thus the siege of Lamia became a turning point in the war. Antipater now had the opportunity to gather his strength and make a full assault on Greece. Despite the naming convention, the real shift in the war came not from Antipater, but from Cletus the White. The White, purely as a funny little convention ancient historians use to distinguish him from Cletus the Black, who had been murdered by Alexander in Bactria. Apparently, this Cletus had been given an important job by Alexander the Great before the late king's death, overseeing the construction of a massive war fleet in Phoenicia. Originally intended for Alexander's next campaign, Cletus took 240 ships that were already completed and their Phoenician crews north to Anatolia. The eastern Mediterranean is difficult to sail in the winter, so the Hellenic Navy had gone to winter garrisons for the season, with small pockets of ships dotted all over the region. Cletus hit them before they could regroup, with his massive Macedonian navy wiping out Athenian and Rhodian ship depots one by one from Cilicia to the Hellespont, then west towards Macedon's home waters. The largest confrontation took place off the coast of Amorgos, an island in the Cyclades, where 170 Athenian ships managed to gather, only to be entirely sunk or disabled by Cletus's fleet. With the Hellenic navy functionally destroyed, Craterus was able to set sail from Cilicia at long last. His transport fleet had enough room to carry 6 of his 10,000 veterans to Amphipolis, alongside 1,000 Iranian archers and slingers, which really wasn't helping the image of Macedon as a new Persian empire. He also picked up an additional 5,500 men along the way. Together with the army that Antipater had assembled in Macedon, they totaled around 48,000 men, including 5,000 cavalry, finally outnumbering the Thessalian horsemen and dwarfing the 25,000 infantry in the Hellenic army. The two armies met near the Thessalian city of Kranon, and the Greeks were quickly overwhelmed. When they tried to pull back into the city, Antipater and Craterus just stormed the gates and forced the rebels to surrender. The Macedonians refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of the Hellenic League and went through the tedious process of signing separate treaties with each belligerent to prove their point. Back in Athens, the leaders of the anti-Macedonian faction fled into exile once again, but that would not save the city. The property requirements for participating in the assembly were tightened, dramatically reducing the number of eligible voters in the Athenian democracy, effectively turning Athens into an oligarchy. They were stripped of territory granted to Athens for supporting Philip II decades earlier. The Piraeus, Athens' harbor, had to host a Macedonian garrison, and they were forced to pay a massive indemnity that functionally ended the classical age in Athens. Their marble and metalworking industries dried up for a lack of customers, and public building projects were cut short in lieu of funding. In the years that followed, a wave of assassinations passed over Greece as former rebel leaders were tracked down by Macedonian agents. It was, effectively, the end of Greek political life as we've known it for the last 120 episodes. Sure, they were technically still organized into regional leagues and nominally autonomous city-states, but Antipater made it clear that the facade of a common peace in the Corinthian League was over. The Greeks were Macedonian subjects now. While all of this was happening, ironically, there still wasn't a king actually in Macedon. Perdiccas, Roxane, and the kings Philip Aridaeus and Alexander IV were still making the slow trek toward Europe all through 322. Of course, this was partly thanks to Alexander IV's birth, which would have slowed them down no matter what, but it was also due to Leonatus. See, Leonatus was supposed to be assisting Eumenes of Cardia, now the satrap of Paphlagonia, in his conquest of Cappadocia. Leonatus went to stop the Greek uprising and got killed, so Perdiccas now had to flex his authority as regent, take the royal army that was acting as his honor guard, and march up to Cappadocia to face one of the last bastions of Achaemenid rule himself. Of course, that royal army in this case were some of the most battle-hardened and experienced veterans of all time in 322. Some of these guys had been at war for multiple decades. The Persian satrap Ariarathes is not all that well documented, but the conclusion is pretty clear. Cappadocia couldn't field enough local troops or afford enough mercenaries to compete with an outright, fully staffed invasion force. Ariarathes and his family were captured by Perdiccas and crucified. Finally, Perdiccas and the royal entourage reached Anatolia in late 322 with plans to cross the Aegean in the next spring. But another of Alexander's former generals made the crossing first. Over in Greece, the Aetolian League was still resisting Antipater and Craterus well into 321, since they had withdrawn their troops from the Hellenic army before the defeat at Crannon. Suddenly, Antigonus Monophthalmos arrived in the besieging Macedonian camp to meet Antipater and Craterus, delivering a warning. Antigonus refused Perdiccas' summon to fight in Cappadocia, and instead raced ahead from his own satrapy to warn his comrades that Perdiccas wanted to execute them for pulling Leonidas away from the war in the east. But Antigonus may have misrepresented the situation. With Leonidas dead, Perdiccas didn't have anything against Antipater or Craterus. But he was now angry with Antigonus himself. Understandably concerned by Antigonus' claim, the Macedonians concluded a hasty peace treaty with the Aetolians, basically agreeing to leave them alone while the Macedonians went back to Pella to prepare for Perdiccas. Antipater, Perdiccas, and Craterus all effectively felt like they were the rightful regent, and Antipater set out to forge a lasting alliance between the three of them. He arranged rushed marriages between one of his daughters and Craterus, and sent another daughter across the Aegean to meet and marry Perdiccas in Cilicia. So when the official regent reached Pella with the new kings, the three leading generals of the empire would be united through bonds of matrimony, and things initially looked like they would stabilize. Initially. Even as that pact was solidifying, the empire's stability was already coming undone. Olympias, mother of Alexander the Great and Antipater's longtime political rival, had encouraged one of her Molossian vassals to join the Greek cause. And even though that particular warlord switched sides after Lamia, Olympias feared for her own life. So, she abandoned her post as regent queen of Molossia and fled east with her daughter, Alexander's younger sister, Cleopatra. According to rumors that never came to fruition, Cleopatra had proposed a marriage between herself and Leonidas before he died, in a bid for Leonidas and Cleopatra to usurp the throne. The two royal women reached Sardis in Lydia in 321. Olympias and Cleopatra secretly offered Cleopatra's hand to Perdiccas, effectively offering him the throne in exchange for his support against Craterus and Antipater. Cleopatra's motivation here is obvious enough, and this really highlights how insecure Olympias must have felt now that her only blood connection to imperial power was an infant grandson that she had never even seen. Simultaneously, Cunane, one of Alexander's half-sisters, proposed a different marriage between her own daughter Eurydice and her half-brother Philip Aridaeus. Cunane commanded a fiercely loyal regiment of Macedonian soldiers and was essentially offering to make Philip the sole king, with Cunane and Eurydice by his side as the true power behind the throne. This did not go well. Cunane and Eurydice, both trained and practiced in fighting on the front line with their troops, led their regiment to the Hellespont to meet Philip, but Antipater caught wind of the plan and sent a small army to block their way. Cunane ordered her troops to advance toward the Hellespont, and Alcestis, the general sent by Antipater, attacked. According to the historian Polyinus, Cunane attempted to emulate her more famous brother and attacked Alcestis himself in battle, but Alcestis got the upper hand and killed the princess himself. Cunane's troops and Eurydice withdrew with their general's body, but rallied to battle Alcestis once again in vengeance. Antipater ultimately stepped in and ordered his subordinate to stand down. He also sent word ahead to Perdiccas explaining the situation, and Eurydice was, in fact, wed to Philip Aridaeus as her mother's dying wish when she crossed the Hellespont to join the royal court. Unbeknownst to most of the parties involved, Perdiccas had actually decided not to go to Europe. Instead, he sent Eumenes of Cardia to Sardis with gifts and a positive response to Cleopatra's marriage proposal. But Menander, the satrap of Lydia now, sent a letter to the three generals in Macedon revealing this new development. When Perdiccas arrived in Sardis, he turned Roxane, Alexander IV, Eurydice, and Philip Aridaeus over to Olympias' supervision for the time being, and met with the loyal generals and satraps of the region to plan their next move. Perdiccas' first step to become the unchallenged leader of what was, in effect, still the Persian Empire, was the obvious choice for a prospective King of Kings. Invade Egypt! While this Macedonian scheming had been going on, Ptolemy was busy in the south. He had married a different Eurydice now, another daughter of Antipater, as part of the former regent's grand plan for an alliance. He was also the satrap of Egypt. Well, Alexander the Great's corpse, a powerful symbol of legitimacy, was supposed to be on its way to Egypt. For years, Alex made it clear that he wanted to be entombed in the Egyptian style at the Siwa Oasis, where his supposed divinity was revealed by the Oracle of Amun. However, Ptolemy was concerned that Perdiccas and the others would try to take it to the traditional tombs in Macedon anyway. So the satrap of Egypt conspired with the general in charge of the funeral procession and made sure it was diverted to Egypt. Instead of going to Siwa, Ptolemy had the royal corpse taken to Memphis for the time being, and added a grand tomb to the ongoing construction project at Alexandria near Egypt at the northwest corner of his new country. This gave Ptolemy a real air of legitimacy as the one who not only had the body of Alexander, but also was the closest to actually honoring the late king's dying wish. Plus, it was the rich, bountiful land of the Nile, the eternal prize of empire. So, in May of 321 BCE, Perdiccas led an army south from Lydia toward Egypt. And that will be the story next time. Remember, everyone, today's episode was the cool period of peace before the all-out conflagration of civil war. It only gets hotter from here. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.